afternoon. My name is Scott Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And welcome and thank you for coming. I appreciate it very much. I will quote, as Miss Linda does, Lois Wilson, who said in the moment of silence she invited God to the meeting. I'm going to ask you to do that. We're going to do something a little bit unusual. Years ago, I took a meeting into one of the gated communities. That's a jail, okay? And we opened with a serenity prayer, and it sounded more like an invitation to a fight than a prayer. God, grant me the serenity. Everybody in there is suffering from testosterone poisoning, and I thought, I can't listen to them do this to the Lord's Prayer, so I asked him to whisper it. It changed everything. The prayers for us, I think, have in large measure become ritual rather than prayers. So after a few moments, if you would acknowledge the presence of deity, I'm going to ask you to slowly, I say again, slowly whisper the serenity prayer. Serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's a different thing. I hope you liked it. Again, I want to thank Lee, committee, everybody who was responsible for us having this marvelous opportunity. You guys have been fantastic, and thank you so much. And thanks, too, to those who made us officiate afternoon. Was that not great? Outstanding. Absolutely outstanding. Before I go any further, I need to do something I should have done last night, and this piece is not a joke, by the way, but I have been diagnosed with a central nervous system disorder called essential tremors. And I have a shake. If you shake my hand, you'll notice that my hand pulses. I can't stop that. And I also have an involuntary negative head shake. Every once in a while, I just do one of these. And I don't know it most of the time. So it's going to look like I disagree with something I'm saying. I don't today. Now, I may disagree with it later. I may learn something later. But for right now, if I say it, I actually mean it, okay? So I kind of need to start with that. And I was also remiss last night. I was told, I told you all about my daughter shooting herself, and I didn't tell you the end of the story. She and her husband presented us with a granddaughter 11 years ago, and she's doing fantastic. She is blind in one eye, and she's lost some coordination. And that's not even possible. The doctors said it was not possible. And she's doing great. I talked to her a couple of days ago. So I... So this workshop is actually mistakes I've made and the lessons I've learned. For those of you who are been around AA a while, you'll know the name Keith Lewis. If you don't know the name, get one of his talks. I know John's got some of Keith's talks. He was one of the best we had. And he said, we all have gifts. We must bring them here and give them freely. If we don't, we have to go back out there and die. And I was asked to do a workshop on gifts. One time I thought, what are my gifts? And my gifts are my brokenness and my mistakes. Because we're joined at our brokenness. The book says the fellowship I crave, and I've craved fellowship all my life, never had it. I flew a very highly classified mission in Southeast Asia. There were 10 volunteer crews flying it, and there were multiple co-pilots, navigators, and engineers bugging the men on my crew to fly with, so they could trade and fly with me, and I never felt like I belonged. I looked like I did, but I never felt like it. And what I discovered when I've been with you for a while is that while I'm doing the act, when I'm holding up the mask, I can look like I'm here, but I'm not. Because the mask can't participate in fellowship. Only this part can do that. And I'm not showing you this. Today, I'm going to participate in fellowship. I'm going to show you this. I did some of it last night. And so we're joined at our brokenness. So I have my own definition for some things. Progress is making the same old mistake a little less often. Or making a new and finer quality of mistake. Because anything beyond that, be perfection, that's just not my assignment. I don't think I'm put here to be perfect. Well, if I'm not here to be perfect, what's my job? My job clearly is to make mistakes. And I'm good at it. And all my life I've been told, well, we learn from our mistakes. Really? Well, in that case, nobody in this room has more than one DUI. Maybe not. So folks like me, I'm not saying you are, but folks like me, we don't learn from our mistakes. We learn from living with the results of our mistakes. And if you hold that thought, read the steps, I think you'll see that about half of them are about me embracing the results of my mistakes, where the learning occurs. So this is the learning process as I understand. Oh, another definition for me is a mistake. And the definition is it's an invitation to a lesson. That's all it is. Just if I had already learned the lesson, would not have made the mistake. Page 124 in the book in plain old Tennessee English says, Scott can't make a mistake so ugly that God can't turn it into something magnificent. I didn't say fix. That's who I am. That's who he is. And so this is the learning process as I understand it today. One, make a mistake. Two, be notified I made the mistake. I don't always know. Three, own the mistake. Yeah, that was me. Four, make the amends. Five, learn the lesson. Six, share the lesson. And what I just picked up recently is if I just share the lesson, I'm preaching and nobody wants to hear it. I have to tell you I made the mistake. That makes it easier to be able to hear the lessons. That's what it is for me these days. And before I got to recovery, I kept the bad in and let the good out. If I did something good, I told everybody. If I did something bad, I hid it. Here, it's the exact opposite way. If I do something bad, I have to tell you about it. It's the path to freedom. If I do something good, anonymity says I must keep it to myself. So many things are the exact opposite of what I thought they were. Here's another one I learned, and that's that pain is my best friend. Pain is what tells me something needs to change. My first marriage quit working somewhere right around 6 months before we said the vows. I'd say somewhere right in there. And I bled off the pain from that through a series of illicit affairs and one-night stands, booze and drugs. And I think if I had not done those things, and I had stayed in the present and allowed my good friend Pain to do its job, that lady and I would have gotten some help and gotten it fixed or gotten out of it maybe 20 years before we were finally able to do so. I really need to be careful that I honor my good close friend Pain. Here's one that kind of embarrassed me. I went to an old timer one time after a meeting and I said, you guys told me by the time I was sober a year that my sleep patterns would have leveled out. And they haven't. I don't sleep. And he said, I just watched you drink two big cups of coffee here at an 8 o'clock meeting. And I said, caffeine doesn't affect me. And he said, if you drink a quart of scotch a day and smoke six or eight joints, it won't. And I said, oh. And I wonder today how many things I know for absolutely sure and certain are actually wrong. And I'm looking for them. If you've got something you disagree with me on, I can't wait to hear from you. I don't want to argue with you. But it's an indication there's a lesson for somebody. And I'm in for that. And I never used to want to do that kind of thing. I was standing in the old Woodbine Clubhouse in Nashville having a discussion with another AA member. Now, not being as spiritually evolved as I am, you might have thought it was an argument. And because that's something really important, like maybe whether I'm recovered or recovering, one of those that really needs to be hammered out. And about that time, old Joe B. walked in, and Joe had been sober since about a month before the earth began to cool and was also very intelligent, which clearly going to put him my side on this burning issue, which I can't still remember what it was. And I posed the question to Joe as he poured his coffee, and I said, Joe, what do you think? Joe said, I am not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. I wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorse nor oppose any. By the time he finished that, my opponent and I were both laughing. Now, I'm not a skyrocket to success here. It took me about a month and a half. I went to Joe and I said, you meant that? He said, oh, yeah. Joe was living the AA preamble. You could not draw him into a conflict. He wouldn't come. And he thought primary meant nothing got in front of it. And he was one of the most peaceful people I've ever known. He was just peaceful all the time. And when I can live the AA preamble, I'm pretty peaceful too. My sponsor, Rusty, we called him Rusty. At the end of his drinking, he was drinking mouthwash mixed with Kool-Aid. And he wet his pants so many times his zipper rusted shut. And we nicknamed him Rusty in honor of the zipper. And yeah, you're lucky in AA if you get a nickname you like, by the way. And he liked his. He liked that one. But he said, I'm not responsible for what I think. I'm responsible for how long I think it. I can't keep the garbage from showing up here, but when it gets dirty up here, I can sweep. Another one he talked about was, I got to AA as a taker. I've been a taker all my life. And I thought I was going to have to transition from taker to giver, and I don't believe that's possible because a taker doesn't have anything. I had to transition from taker to receiver. The difference is receivers say things like, thank you, and I don't understand, and would you please help me? And I appreciate you. And having received for a while, I thought, now what's going to keep me close to God is my willingness to give. And it is, but the real magic is in being willing to receive. Because this one contains humility. I can give from behind my shields. I hope I don't do that today, but I can. But I can't receive from behind my shields. And I think it's spiritual law. You can't give without receiving. You can't receive without giving. I don't think it can be done. The most selfish thing I ever do. My experience is that when you're having a rough go, and I get a chance to love on you and be of assistance to you, I get this wonderful closeness to God by doing so. When I'm having a rough go, if I don't let you know, I block your chance to get close to God by giving. And it's one of the most selfish things I could do, and it almost killed me. It's an important thing. Here's another. It talks about somebody whose ego knows no bounds. I get a phone call one day 15 years ago, and this voice said, Don Pritz was supposed to be our speaker Saturday night, 2 weeks out. He just called. He's having some surgery, and he's recommended you. Can you come? And I looked at the calendar and said, yeah, sure. So I walk into the living room. Linda looks at me and says, what happened? And I told her that, and I said, they've asked me to fill Don Pritz's shoes. She said, no, they haven't. They've asked you to fill his time slot. My ego knows no bounds, and I really need that kind of thing. One of the other things from Keith Lewis, he said he couldn't afford to be in any 50-50 relationships. If I'm in 50-50, I'm keeping score. I need to be in 100-0. Some days I can do that. Some days, not that many. This is an adult crowd, and I think this is an important thing. It has been, apparently. I noticed Linda and I have been back together for 3 years. And one of the patterns I noticed within the first 18 months is we make love tonight, we're going to have a fight tomorrow morning. It was consistent. And I could not figure out why. And then I finally did work it out. She helped me a little bit with it, but I worked it out. It looks like we're going to be playful tonight. I'm a pretty attentive guy this afternoon. Tomorrow morning is just another day to me. It's not to her. And if I'm not attentive tomorrow morning, she feels used and cheap. And look at all the ladies nodding. I'm hoping some of you guys saw that. But I've had some guys come up to me and say, wow, I've seen the same pattern. I didn't know what was wrong. I need to be attentive tomorrow morning. It's an important thing. And that was a bad mistake. And it's not anymore. This is what Dr. Bob said, page 178. At the bottom, for some reason, we alcoholics seem to have the gift of picking out the world's finest women. I agree with him on that. Why they should be subjected to the tortures we inflict upon them, I cannot explain. I can't either. But we're doing better. My boss, who was the senior partner, I was also a partner. He and I were, when I got sober, we were stealing $25,000 a year from our own company through our expense account. $1,984. That's not an estimate. It was get $2,000 a month out of your expense account. I'm going to get my two. Take a $1,000 cash advance at the National Trade Show. $25,000. It takes me a year to figure out that might be in violation of the spiritual principles I'm trying to live. Because I'm not a skyrocket to success. And he and I actually wound up divorcing over that. And I took one of the other guys and we started a new business. That would have been in June of 85. Sometime in September of 85, I realized that my spirituality had been gone. I had the big white light experience. I've been the victim of fabulous sponsorship that took me through the steps. I've got all kinds of great stuff going on. It took me a couple of weeks to realize that's all gone. That all I think about is this business that's circling the drain. And it's getting pretty close. And I bet it all. And I went to old timers and I said, what should I do? And they said, turn it over. And I said, how? And no one could tell me. I don't ask you to believe this came from God. I need you to know that I believe it did because I prayed. And I said, how do I turn this over? and this is what I got. If I can turn what I turn over is the result, how it comes out. If I can turn over what I consider to be the very worst possible result, then I'll have it all turned over. So in my mind, on that situation, what's the worst possible result? And the answer is lose the business, go bankrupt, lose the car, lose the house, and have to get a real job working for somebody else. That is as ugly as I could imagine it. And I took that to God in prayer in detail. And I said, if this is your will, send it. And I didn't mean it. And that was the only problem I really had. I think worry is my soul shivering in the shade of something I placed between me and the sunlight of the Spirit. And I had done that with that business, and I did not know it. And I prayed that prayer morning and night, and every time I thought about the business for a period of time, my best eyeball is 10 days. I'm not sure. It's September of 85, a long time. I don't know. About 10 days later, all of a sudden, one time, my soul stepped out from that shadow. And if that was His will, I was in. And I got this wonderful sense of peace. Nothing else had changed. We were closer to the drain. Nothing else had changed. But I was just okay that I had found a way to let go of the result. Such an important thing. I've had to use that a number of times since then. I had to do that when Linda and I were not too far from getting back together, and I didn't know that. And I finally prayed to Him one day, and I said, I'm the one that blew this. I'm the one that threw this away. I deserve everything I'm getting, and I can't ask for her back. But if there's something I can do that will help her heal, if you'll let me know, I'll be happy to do it. That was as far as I could go. And it was that day I was able to let go of it. That was a couple of years into that divorce. Anyway, so I prayed that prayer and then about the business, and I eventually was given the gift of meaning it. I can't make myself mean it. I can't change me. If I could change me, I would not have come here. I would just change me, and I'd go be doing something else. But I can change what I do today, and therein lies tremendous power. Because day after day, as I do something different, I become changed. But I don't change me, I can't. And anyway, about 3 or 4 days after I got that turned over, that business made a 180 and took off like a turpentine cat. I mean, it was rolling. And it rolled for a number of years after that. About 2 years later, it occurred to me that I owed amends to the Internal Revenue Service. So I went to my accountant, who was a member of our fellowship, and I said, I owe $25,000 for several years. What do I do? And not include jail time would be good. And he said, oh, it's easy. We just refile. You give them the money. I did that. They can come hunt me. I got right with them. Page 60 in the text. It's going to get better. Page 60 says, on that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. What that tells me is I can't trust my motives. I got that lesson years ago. I was a commissioned salesman, and I called on a major account. There was a particular purchasing agent at that account that represented a third of my income. I was making a lot of money. We were personal friends. Our wives are friends. We're guests in each other's homes. He's in the process of moving merchandise from other vendors to my vendors. Because he likes me, because I represent good companies, I give him good, but it's good. And I get a phone call from him one day, and he says, my wife just gave birth. And I'm close enough to know this is not good news. We're 2 months early. And he says, we're at Vanderbilt Hospital, and it's not going very well. Would you come pray with this child? I said, you bet. And I hop in my car, and I do what I've been hearing in meetings, check my motives. And I can't answer the question. Am I going to the hospital to pray over a sick child to bring spiritual relief to this family? Or am I going to the hospital to pray for a sick child to look good to this guy so I put another $100,000 in my pocket? I can't answer the question. Pull into a parking place and can't answer the question. I'm out of time. He knows where I live. He knows how long. It's only a 10-minute drive. He knows that. I got to go in. I just prayed. And I said, I think I need an answer. I think I need it now. Again, I don't ask you to believe it came from God. I believe it did. And the next thing I got was this exceptionally clear thought. I don't know how to describe it. I didn't hear a voice. But this exceptionally clear thought was, does going into a hospital to pray over a sick child violate any of your principles? The answer was no. Then go ahead and do it. Because there are no wrong reasons for doing the right thing. We don't care why Scott did the right thing. We care that Scott did the right thing. Conversely, there are no right reasons for doing the wrong thing. And that was where I learned that principle always trumps motive. Cliff Roach, if you never heard Cliff, don't go to bed tonight without getting one of the Cliffers talks. I know he's got some of those. Cliff says that 12 traditions are a set of principles that are designed to protect AA from my very best motives. Because that's what principles do, is they protect me from my motives. If I want God in my life, I have to treat Him like He's real. And I had an experience late in my drinking. There was he was a sales manager for one of the companies that I represented. He had been a Green Beret. He went into Laos in the early 1960s and took M16s into the hill tribesmen who were carrying crossbows when he got there, and led them in combat on the ground in Laos when the president was swearing every day we weren't there. Well, he was. And he doesn't know how many times he's killed with his hands. He doesn't know. And I flew a gunship. I don't know that we ever worked together, but guys flying my kind of airplane saved his bacon a number of times. So he felt very close to me. And I knew some things probably would have been better that I didn't know. And one of them was he was sleeping with a boss's daughter. And I was drunk one night, said something about it, and it got back to him. And, of course, I lied my way out of it. I get sober. And I might have to make this amend. Yeah, wow, it's correct. And he came to Nashville. He was working at a trade show at the Opryland Hotel. And I called him, said, I want to see you. Oh, yeah, come on over. Big close friends. Yeah, come on over. And I was told if I wanted God to be real in my life, I had to treat Him like He was real. So I did prayer and meditation, and I invited God to go with me. And went around to the passenger side of the car and opened the door and moved the stuff and asked Him to get in. We got where we were going. I went around and asked Him to go in. And I can remember standing outside that man. He was on the third floor. I think I could take you to the room. I can remember standing outside the door like this, knowing that if this man decides to kill me, and he could in the next 2 or 3 minutes, I won't even be able to slow it down. And I was able, and I don't hold me up as a shining example of this thing. I am not one. This is about if you want God to be real in your life, treat Him like He's real. And I knocked on that door and went in and told Him the truth. And 2 months later, Linda and I were guests in his home for a week. Unbelievable. Don't doubt the power here. Another story from my buddy Wall Street Dan. On Black Thursday in 87, whatever it was, he lost $10 million that day. Look up bad day in your dictionary. That's Dan's picture. And and when I started sponsoring him, he had just moved out of a borrowed automobile into a very small apartment. And he gets a voicemail one day and says, "This is Agent Smith with the Internal Revenue Service, and you have an appointment in my office Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock on Church Street. And if that's in conflict with your schedule, I'd like to suggest you change your schedule." And they handed him a bill for $162,000. And he'd been living in a borrowed car. And he said, "What to do?" And I said, "Treat God like He's real." And so he collected up what he had and did the process I talked about, move the stuff, invite God into it. He said the next time he walked into the agent's office, there were 2 chairs on his side of the desk. And he knew he was going to win. 6 months later, when the dust settled on that, they wrote him a check for $1,200. Amazing, amazing stuff. I had the privilege of sponsoring a fellow in the Soviet Union. He lives in Kiev. And I think we've got more 20-year chips in my home group on Sunday morning in Nashville than they've got in the entire Soviet Union. There's just not a lot of long-term. They don't have a lot of people to go to, and I get all these questions. And he used to call me and say, "All right, I sponsor a guy in Moscow who sponsors a guy in Siberia who, this is what he did, what's the amend?" And I say to him, the sponsor and sponsee need to sit quietly in God's presence a few times, and I believe a way will be shown. If it's not, call me. He don't call. He doesn't call. One of my favorite stories, two of them, fellow I sponsored had as about the third grade, grabs another kid's stocking cap on the schoolyard like this on an autumn afternoon. Nobody's looking. He flings it up in a tree. It disappears. And they never did find the hat. Kids from a poor family goes through that winter without a hat. And here we are 30 years later. He doesn't know the kid's first or last name. The school is no longer there. Clearly not possible to make amends. Don't you doubt it. And he and I sat there quietly in God's presence. And today, all the kids at the orphanage in Nashville have Tennessee Titans stocking caps. My sponsor got free. Yeah. Another one, I have an earthling friend who clearly not one of our people. And he asked me, he saw the changes in me and said, "Can I do the steps?" I said, "Sure, you qualify for Al-Anon, having me as a friend." So So if you go to a couple Al-Anon meetings a week, and you don't drink champagne at your daughter's wedding, and you don't smoke a joint with your girlfriend, because I want you present, I'll take you through the steps. And he said, okay, it was no big deal for him. And I don't know what else is wrong with him. And in the amends process, he went to a lady whose charms he had availed himself of lightly 25 years ago and discovered a daughter and two grandchildren. And they're a family today. I love these stories. That's the kind of stuff that happens here. This thing about speaking at conferences fell out of the sky on me when I was sober 10 years. And I mentioned last night his name was Charlie. He's this fellow, one of my customers in Morristown, Tennessee, who was religious and spiritual. I don't find them traveling together all the time, but they did with Charlie. And he was so excited for me when I got sober and I started speaking at conferences. He said, can I hear one? I said, yeah, I'll bring you the next one. And I'm on the way to Charlie's office and I realize I've said something on this cassette that I don't want Charlie to hear. So I didn't give it to him. I lied out of it. And I said, I'll bring you the next one. I was on the way to Charlie's office the next time, and I realized I've said something on this CD, this cassette, that I don't want Charlie to hear. Charlie died. And what I realized was that I never have any reason to say anything into an AA microphone I wouldn't want Charlie to hear. And then I realized there's no reason for me ever in an AA meeting to do that. I don't know who's here. I don't know who brought their preacher to hear this spiritual program. I don't know who's here. And then I realized I don't ever in my life ever have any reason to say anything I want Charlie to hear. I can't live that, but I'm trying to. I'm trying to. It's important for me to clean up my language. I got sober. I need to get my adverbs back. This is a lesson I picked up a couple of years ago. I'm hung on the horns of a dilemma. And dilemma is two options, not knowing which one to do. And what I realized was, when I get in that situation, if I'll take a real look at it and ask myself, which one would I rather do? The correct answer is the other one. Because if the one I wanted to do were the correct one, there would be no dilemma. I'm sorry, because you're stuck with that. You know, knowledge is a terrible thing. Once you get it, there's no way to put it back. And I've had to use that one. This is a fun one. I'm going to ask, who here has had this experience? Someone who has a right to ask you a question has just asked you a question you did not know the answer to the moment they asked you. And you open your mouth and a beautiful piece, not BS, but a beautiful piece of the great truth fell out. And 3 hours later, you can't quote it. Sometimes you can't remember what it was. Who's had that experience? Put them way up. Look at this. Yeah. My buddy Joe Krogan, don't go to bed tonight without getting one of Joe's talks. Joe calls those postcards from God. Dear Scott, you've got to be doing something right or we couldn't have pulled that off. Love God. I love those things. And I got one not too long ago with a sponsee. He was talking about a problem with somebody at his home group. And I didn't know this when I said it. And I said, isn't part of our assignment to love the unlovable? Isn't that it? I think the love's the strongest force of the universe, and it's clearly the most attractive. I had the privilege of hearing President Ford and actually their son talk about his mother one time. He was in Nashville, and we got to hear it. And this is her story. He says she told the kids all the time. She said, the hummingbird and the buzzard fly over the exact same field. One looking for something beautiful, one looking for something ugly, and they both find what they're looking for. And I get to decide each morning, am I a hummingbird or am I a buzzard? With your help, I'm having more hummingbird days than buzzard days. I still have some buzzards, but they don't seem to stick too long. And forgive a soapbox, but I think we're giving love a bad name. I hear people use the phrase unconditional love. That always rubs my fur the wrong way because it implies conditional love. If the word unconditional modifies love, then there is conditional love, and I don't believe there is. I think we're insulting love. And love is just love. It doesn't need a modifier. The other one that bothers me is tough love. I don't think so. I can tell somebody something they're not going to like very gently and with a lot of real love. Everybody I've ever seen applying what they call tough love looked like unresolved control issues to me. And I'm sorry, that's what I saw. This is one of several gifts from a lady in my home group. She is sitting in a meeting one day and she says, I went to a dog race. And I paid my $2, and I'm sitting there, and the mechanical rabbit takes off, and they pop the cages and shoot the gun. The dogs take off. And she said the mechanical rabbit malfunctioned just before the first turn and stopped. And the lead dog hit the rabbit. Now, he's muzzled, but he hits the rabbit in third gear. And the dog and the mechanical rabbit are tail over tea kettle into the ditch. And I was thinking, as you're thinking, where does this go? And she said, you know, I'm just like that dog. I'm shot out of a gun chasing some dead gum mechanical rabbit that ain't going to be what I want if I can catch it. And then she said, that dog is smarter than I am. They have to retire that dog. He will never chase another mechanical rabbit. Not me. I'm after the next one. I wish he hadn't done that. One of the many songwriters in my home group gave us what she reduced what we do here to what she called the four ups. Get up, give up, show up, fess up. There it is. I thought that was beautiful. Tell a story from a guy from my very early recovery. We'll call him Edward. We should. That's what he said his name was. It's the right thing. I'm sitting in a meeting and Edward's chairing one day, and it's just rubbing my fur the wrong way. I don't like the way this man drinks his coffee. And I hear my sponsor's voice in the back of my head saying, if you spot it, you got it. And I looked at what Edward was doing and realized I do that too. And the next time Edward bugged me, the voice said it again. I looked again and found it again. And Edward became one of my greatest teachers. And at that time, the meeting would split up into various places. I always followed Edward. And Edward had all of my character defects. Now, he had them a lot worse than I do. I have to tell you the whole truth here. But I learned so much. It says love and tolerance is our code. Love and tolerance. If I'm having to tolerate somebody, there's a pretty good chance that they've got a lesson for me. My sponsor, Rusty, told me this one. He said, in the history of planet Earth, no human has ever been put in an insane asylum for being insane. Never, not once. They put us in there for acting insane. And none of us has ever been let out for being sane. They let us out for acting sane. And so on those days when I'm crazy, if I don't act on it, they don't know. I fool them by the hundreds. I tell you, you're ready for it. They are not. This is one from the lady with the dog race. She said, life's tough. First you get the test, then you get the lesson. Then if you don't get the lesson, you get the test again. And that's been my experience. I talked last night about the little boy fishing and doing something anonymously and not getting caught. One of my teachers some time ago said words to the effect of, if there was something I'd kind of like to have for myself, I might try giving it to other folk. And what I'd like to be is joyful. And so I started looking for ways to spread joy. And here's some of the ones that I found. Up my way, and I suspect here, if you find a penny on the ground, it's heads up, it's a lucky penny, you pick it up. I not only don't pick those up, if the tails, I bend over and turn them over. I'm 74 years old. Bending over is a big deal. I think, is there something else I need to do while I'm down here? Because I do not want to come back. And but just to lift somebody else's spirits just a little bit. I don't take my change out of vending machines. Put the dollar bill in and get the pack of crackers, 35 cents. I leave it. You know how fun it is to find a little extra change? It costs me 35 cents to lift somebody's day. Price is right on that. I'm playful in lines and on elevators. I drop change at a bus stop. I'm doing okay. I'm not wealthy, but I'm doing all right. Go by a bus stop. Folks riding the bus maybe not doing so good. Drop 75 cents, whatever I got in my pocket. Find that. Lift somebody's day. I try to compliment as many people as I can every day. I thank as many people as I can every day, especially on the weekends where somebody's working and I'm not. Thanks for coming to work on the weekend. I appreciate you being here. I got the lesson on a Christmas day many, many years ago. I was we ran out of milk Christmas morning. So at halftime, right, I raced out to the car, roared down the convenience store, ran it back there, and first one up. And just all of a sudden, I got this gift. And the gift is my spirit saw this human being. There was a guy standing behind a counter. In those days, probably working for time and a half minimum wage. Pretty good guess on Christmas Day. And my heart said to him out loud, thank you for coming to work on Christmas Day. I bet there's someplace you'd rather be. but my family ran out of milk. If you hadn't come in today, we couldn't have bought it. I appreciate you being here. And he and I both cried. And that was where I got that one. I need to be thanking people as much as I can. I want the world to be a better place because I was here today. And I can do that by spreading joy. Another one that I got, it was about December 23rd, just about time to go Christmas shopping. And so I hop in a car and I'm trying to get into the Green Hills Mall and I watch that light change four times. And that's a combination of rain and snow spitting out of there. And I finally make the turn into the mall. And there's the store I want to go in. And as I begin to turn down that parking lane, the lady pulls out of the place right next to the handicapped. And I realize I can't take that. It's not mine. I'm young. My legs are in good shape. And I drive by that parking place and leave it for somebody I'll never see to lift their day. You know how fun it is on a day like that to find a really good parking place. I'm not holding myself up as an example here. I am not one. But to talk about the idea, part of my morning prayer is I ask God to help me not judge anyone. Jeez, I'm so judgmental. To help me not miss any chances to be of service or to spread joy or to spread love. And aren't those things really all the same? I think they probably are. And I think the closer I can walk to Him, the better I do in all of those categories. Another one that's really fun, this one actually happened back in my drinking days. I was in a hotel at a major convention, and we're on the fourth floor, and you can't get an elevator. I thought, it's only four floors. We're walking down. So let's go down the stairs. We step out, and there's a box with eight red roses in it. Well, we took the roses, and the rule was any woman who looked at us and smiled got one. And the first lady that smiled might have been 90 years old. She got a rose. We just passed them out and had fun. Gee, you want to have some fun? Go buy a couple of dozen roses and just stand somewhere. I did that in Key West a little while ago. I just stand in front of a grocery store and just gave roses to people. It's fun. It's fun. Let me give you a misread that I had for the longest time on page 77. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and the people about us. I thought my job was to be a maximum service. It's not. It's to fit myself. I'm where my work is to be done. I wouldn't know what maximum service looked like. How would I know? So I need to fit myself through the prayer and meditation and all of that stuff. I complained to my sponsor. I was sober about 6 months, 8 months. And I said, what's this thing about AA's all being 100% willing? There's five of us in this clubhouse that do everything and 100 of them that do nothing. What is this? And he said, AA's are 100% willing. And I started to argue. He said, no, you listen to me. He said, and I think the numbers are better than this. He said, 2% are willing to work and the other 98 are willing to let them. And he said, it's your responsibility to be part of the two, to make sure the men you sponsor are part of the two, make the other 98 welcome when they get back from their next slip. Those are my instructions, and I understand them. I think the numbers are better than that, but the concept is so valid. I can't find a theme in the big book more often than the one of go help somebody else, go be of service. I found it in like 52 places, and that's just in the basic text. That's not even with going into stories. He also told me this. He said, acceptance does not have to include approval. Acceptance is when I stop fighting on a heart level, something over which I have no power. If I have power, I need to be in the game. But if I don't, acceptance is when I stop fighting in here, something over which I have no power. I only get a certain amount of spiritual energy on any given day. And if I squander it on things over which I have no power, I won't have enough love for my own assignments for today. Not asking you to approve of what they did, but to stop fighting it on a heart level. That really changed me. He gave me this, and the meetings back then were 20, 25 people. And he said, what do you do in a meeting where you're the chairman and somebody starts running long? And I said, I guess interrupt. He said, take a group conscience. I said, how do you do that? He said, look around the room. If people are digging and scratching and looking at their watches, the group is saying interrupt. If they're all frozen looking at the speaker, the group is saying let them talk. I just share that as good information for me. So if the group is saying interrupt, first thing you do is take off your watch and hold it up like this. And then a minute later you interrupt and say, forgive me, but it's my job as chairman to keep this thing moving. I'm sure there's someone else to be glad to talk to you after the meeting. And I started doing that, and it's worked well for me. My sponsor, Ice Cream Steve, His voicemail, you dial, go ring, ring, click, click. It ain't them. It ain't them. It ain't them. Leave a message. Beep. Usually by the third, it ain't them. I didn't have to leave a message. He finally took that off of his phone because he got, well, he did. He got tired of people saying, hey, I didn't want to talk to you. I want to hear your message. So he literally had to take it off of his phone. I had an experience. I was sober somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 years, sitting at my desk typing one night, and all of a sudden I get this twinge in my lower back. Within 10 minutes, it was the worst pain I had ever felt, have ever felt to date. It was just unbelievably painful. And I'm sitting shotgun, and my first wife was driving. We're getting on the interstate, and it occurred to me I could be dying. It was that bad. And I was given a gift, and the gift was I was able to pray this prayer and mean it. I said, God, I've tried to turn my will and life over to you. Never have turned my death over to you. I'm not asking to go, but if this is it, your will be done, not mine. My fear of death pretty much been gone since then. That was kind of a big one for me. My sponsor, Mike. I've had a number of sponsors. They only take me for so long, and I have to move on. But. He said step 7 didn't say anything at all about me working on my character defects. And when I work on my character defects, it's a classic example of living in the problem. And he said, your character defects are all self-centered by definition. And self can't push self out of the center. If it could, it would leave a vacuum. And I've got 3 particular character defects I call my spiritual barometers. Because in the 7-step prayer, interestingly enough, if I read the short form of the step on the wall, it looks like I'm asking God to take them all. But here in the prayer, it says, remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Not asking him to take them all, just the ones that stand in the way of my usefulness. So I've got these 3 that I call my spiritual barometers. And they are lying, actually improving the truth. Right. Lying. Swearing. I got this little flip phone thing. I turned in that high-tech thing, cut my profanity in half. If I get rid of the computer and lawnmower, I don't think I'd swear at all. But anyway, lying and swearing, and my attitude toward those of you who clearly got your driver's licenses out of Cracker Jack's boxes. And if I notice that one of those is out, if I look, they're all out. They travel together. And they're the indicators that my spiritual program has a leak in it. And Mike said... That we don't focus on the darkness. What we do is we invite the light in, and the light comes, and the darkness flees. It cannot exist in the light. So when I hear me angry with you in traffic or swearing or lying, I look at my spiritual program of the last few days. What's my meeting count? When's the last time I talked to my sponsor and actually told him the whole truth? What's my sponsorship like? When's the last time I took a meeting into a treatment center or a jail? What's my morning in prayer and meditation? I have to look. And there's a hole. For me, it's typically meditation. Meditation works so well for me that I tend to quit doing it. Right? Okay, good. I thought I was in the right place. And so I go back and mend that fence. And you can cut me off in traffic 2 days later and almost hit me. And I will smile at you, a real smile. And I'll wave, and I'll wave my entire hand, wave the whole thing. And I'll say, wow, God, thank you that I smelled he might be cutting me off and I was on the brake. And I wasn't in a wreck. That would have been his fault, but I'm in a wreck. Thank you so much. And go with that child. Looks like he needs some help today. I make mistakes like that myself. And I can't change me from the raving maniac from 3 days ago. I just can't change me. But when I do the things that you've taught me, I become changed. And the darkness can't exist in the light. It just simply can't. One of the hardest things for me to do is to defend myself. I grew up in a home with alcoholism and rage. And my father never struck me, but he was 6'4", and he had a big booming voice. And I was terrified of him. And I learned not to feel. And I learned that how I felt and things that bothered me were not important. And I don't blame him. I've been through this forgiveness process in step 4. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I really hope you'll find out. Anyway, this happened many, many years ago when I was still working. I worked a lot of trade shows in the summer. I'd work a couple of 18-day weeks. Trade show, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, working Monday through Friday, trade show, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And they would back up on me. My sleep's pretty valuable in the summer. So the phone rings one night about 11 o'clock and brings me up out of a deep sleep. And I don't do anything and I don't say anything. And I just lay there for a while. It takes me a long time to go back to sleep. I have a tough couple of days because of it. 4 or 5 days later, it happens again. And I'm just, but I don't do anything and I don't say anything. When it happens the third time in about 10 days, I come out of that bed like I'm shot out of a gun. And roar into my son's room. He is about 12 or 14 years old. And just go off on him. What's supposed to have happened is the first time when I was just irritated, I was supposed to walk into his room and say, Trev, ask him to hold. He said, hang on. What, Dad? Who's on the phone? He said, Carl. Why is he calling here at 11 o'clock at night? He said, well, we're out of school. Carl gets off work at about 10 or 10:30. We like to talk on the phone every night. And I would have said, son, can you call him instead of him calling you? Oh, yeah, he can take calls to midnight in the summer. Thanks, son. I love you. That's how that should have gone. It's not what happened. And it is because I allowed that frustration to build up within me. And it finally detonated. And I just did that to Linda a couple of weeks ago. And I'm not proud of that. I'm a work in process. And this, I talked to somebody, I think I talked to Lee about this. I had the awfulest time with this concept of God's will. So I grew up in the South. Let me say it for another way. God's will. Why'd Grandma die? It was God's will. Well, it killed her. Does not sound like a particularly good deal to me. And so I had to take what that concept meant to me, break it into two pieces. All right. The first piece is, what am I going to be when I grow up? Where am I going to live? How much money am I going to make? What's going to happen to my children? The communists eventually take over the world. The Pygmies in Africa never heard of Jesus. Can they go to heaven? And so on. And all of that violates one day at a time. That's all in the future. I consider that entire category to be God's plan. Second half of the first step says, I management don't need to know what the plan is, leaves me with God's will. Which is very simply, what would he have me do today? I'm an alcoholic. I have a sponsor. I sponsor some guys. I go to meetings. I've done the steps. I read the big book. I'm a child of God. I pray and meditate. I have a wonderful woman in my life. I'm faithful to her today. I got some kids. I'm trying to be a good dad. I have some grandchildren. I'm a pretty good granddad. I drive a car. Put your blinker on near me in traffic. I will let you in. I know what God's will is for me. It's to walk humbly in his presence today. Connected to him as best I can be. Treating you guys like brothers and sisters. I got it. That simplified that for me. It was a huge thing for me. I just share it for you in case it wasn't. This is a gift from Don Major. If you've never heard Don, don't go to bed tonight without getting one of his talks. I think he's the best we got on step 6 and 7. But he said this to me. He said, I cannot allow how I feel to affect what I do. It is not what I think, feel, believe, interpret that keeps me in recovery. It is singularly what I do. And I can't afford the price of allowing how I feel to affect what I do. The day before I got to recovery, how I felt made all of my choices. Today, it's the single least important thing in my life because I cannot allow it to be involved in the process of deciding what I need to do. Choice is never singular. When I choose anything, I choose everything that goes with it, and I choose not to have any things that can't go with it. To be very careful. And I heard this 25 years ago. I thought it was really clever. The longer I look at it, the truer it becomes. That most of the problems I have today are actually solutions that I chose to previous problems. Cook them for a little while. See if it doesn't work for you. It sure did to me. I want to talk a little bit about one day at a time, which I think is the single most difficult assignment I've ever been given. Just to just be here present in my own life. And I talked about it a little bit last night. But all the good questions contain the word today and all the good answers contain the word today. And the question isn't, what am I going to do about my finances? It's the wrong question. What am I going to do about my finances today? What do I do about my relationship? What am I going to do about it today? You feel the difference in that? This one day at a time is a tough, tough assignment. But my God is the God of right now. My experience is that if my sponsor will hold one hand, he'll hold the other while we go into my past to do step work. When I go into the future, I go alone, and I'm in bad company. And using the word today helps me stay in today. And I've given myself this assignment once in the last 18 months. I've given it to most of the men I sponsor more than once. To take some legal pads, cut them in half, take a Sharpie, write the word today. One on top of the socks in the sock drawer, one on top of the underwear, one on the mirror where you shave, one on the dashboard of your car. It's a screensaver on your computer. And use the word today, and use it a lot, to help me stay here. It is the salve for worry. Because worry is just my will trying to figure out a way to get itself done at some time in the future. It just makes me crazy. I heard somebody say, worry is just low-grade atheism. Worry is how I tell God I don't think He can handle my future very well. I had an experience in meditation. I was sober about 2 years, and I don't think I told this last night. Forgive me if I did, but my first sponsee who was going to live, he and I floated. Well, I mean, don't worry about it. You're going to have to kill a few. And he and I floated that Buffalo River and fished a lot his first year or so sober. And I don't get visualizations very often, but I was sitting in meditation. I got one. And he and I were out in the canoe. He was in the front. I'm in the back, right by the bluff on the Buffalo River. And I can see it in my meditation from my seat in the back and also from the port side of the canoe about a couple hundred yards away. And it was just this beautiful scene of these two guys that loved each other and loved God playing on a river. And my monkey mind talked to me and said, Scott, you rotten SOB. Here you are out playing on the river with Ron and you're supposed to be trying to get close to God. And I believe I heard God's voice, and I heard it in my solar plexus. And He said, if you want to get close to me, work with my people. And I came up out of meditation like stepping on a rake, and it just startled me. I was sober 2.5 years, maybe, something like that. And my ego knows no bounds. What I heard was, help those that are not as far down the path as you are. Got 2.5 years. It took me a couple of years to realize that might mean work with those that are further down the path than you are, turkey. And but what I have found is that works for me every time. If I want to get close to Him, I work with you. And then it occurred to me, if I could ask Him a single question and get an answer, what would my question be? And I went through a lot of them because they would the ones that I would come up with would violate the principles. And I finally came up and I have my question. And if that channel ever opens like that again, I'm going to ask it. I'd encourage you to spend some time and think about that. It's a pretty good thing to think about, better than some of what I think about, for sure. And I'll be glad to tell you mine in about a week. There's folks here on the committee on how to get hold of me if you want to know, but I'm going to tell you now because I don't want to take your experience away. It would be the wrong thing. This is a gift from another one of my teachers. He said, your spiritual assignment will change. And when it does, you must release your grip on the old and embrace the new. You'll come to love the new as much as you did the old. And that's been my experience. My spiritual assignment has changed. I now have to tell you those horrible things that I did 25 years sober so that I can talk about the power of God. I thought I'd place myself outside of His love. Isn't that awful? And that's not what happened. This is interesting. Linda normally covers this in her talk, and I got it from her. In step nine, she does something she calls good amends. I'm familiar. I understand the vast majority of the sins of commission, things I did that hurt you. What I don't see is a sense of omission. And I got that from her. And she said I needed to go back and thank people who were important to me. She normally puts this in her talk, and it just wasn't here today. And I went back and thanked my major professor in college. I went back and thanked my first instructor pilot. He was a civilian. I was still a college student. I got 30 hours from him. And he saw the gift that I had and worked me like a borrowed mule. And nothing I did was good enough for him. And he set up my Air Force career. I was able to go back and thank him. And I made amends to my mother. And at a very separate time, I went back and thanked her for all the sacrifices. Told her what a great mom she was. And then I wrote her a letter about what a great mom she was and how much I appreciate her. A lot of details, about a page and a half. My mother died of Alzheimer's in a little nursing home, and she didn't have much left, but she had that letter. Good amends. Pretty interesting thing. It's a gift from Miss Linda from Al-Anon. I had the privilege of knowing Sandy Beach pretty well. I was on a number of conferences with him, and I used to talk to him quite a bit. And when he died, I sat and wrote about him, and if you'll forgive me for reading, this is what I wrote about Sandy. As the recovering community mourns the loss of Sandy Beach, I'd like to take a few minutes to celebrate his passing. I last saw him in May and was pretty sure it would be my final chance to thank him. I'm glad I took it. The English language has a beautiful euphemism for death. We say he passed. I've long believed that planet Earth is a school, and then I probably flunked out of somewhere else or was expelled as a behavior problem. And considering my school metaphor, I'm certain that Sandy passed. If he didn't, the rest of us are in a lot of trouble. Looked to me like he graduated with honors. A few years ago, I was in Florida on business, and I called Sandy and said I was in the neighborhood. Could we have lunch? And he said, yeah. And during the meal, I interrupted him. I said, Sandy, you're a great storyteller. He said, yeah, that's my gift. And then he just went on with whatever the subject had been before my interruption. He was the only person I knew who was unimpressed by Sandy Beach. I guess that is the at least in part what true humility is. Keith Lewis, who Sandy sponsored for many years, used to say, we all have gifts and we don't bring them here and give them freely. We have to go back out there and die. And Sandy gave freely of his gift. Seems to me that all the great teachers in history are storytellers. Christ, Buddha, Aristotle, Plato. We seem to learn best anecdotally. That's why Sandy was such a great teacher. He could paint pictures on your mind, which is a very few words. He probably saved my life a few years ago when he told me, the measure of my recovery isn't whether I get off the path. We all get off the path. The measure of my recovery is how quickly I get back on. I asked him what his mission was when he approached the microphone. His simple reply still echoes from me. He said, comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. I suppose one of his most famous concepts was, I can tell you how to never again be upset because you didn't get your way. Don't have a way. To include all the great things I learned from him, I have to write all day, but I'll close with two of my favorite Sandyisms. Thursday is drive any way you want day. Everyone on planet Earth can drive any way they want every Thursday, and I won't get upset with them. I never believed him on this one. I eagerly bet that every day was drive any day you want day for Sandy. He just brought it down to the bite size of Thursday so guys like me could try it. And my all-time favorite, I've decided to give six people a pass today. The first six people that screw up in front of me get a free pass just for today. I got a credibility problem again. I strongly suspect that Sandy gave everyone a free pass every day. And in freeing them, I think he freed himself. I appreciate your time and your attention. This has been a gift for me to share some of these beautiful things that I have learned, some the hard way. And if you wouldn't mind, I'm going to close like we opened. I'm going to ask you to remain seated. Please don't take anyone's hand. We invited God, and I believe he came, and I think it would be appropriate to thank him. And I would note, too, that most people who use the Lord's Prayer think the author did a fairly decent job with it, and it wasn't necessary to add anything at the end. So I'd like to suggest we don't add anything at the end. If you have a few moments of silence, we're going to slowly, we almost got slowly on the Serenity Prayer, slowly whisper the Lord's Prayer. I'd like to have a few moments of silence after Amen. See if you can let your spirit out of your body and feel the love in this room. I'll let you know when that second moment of silence is over. Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen. God bless us all. Thank you.